This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and fresh from the wilds of Vermont, back home again, is Reuben Jackson, Washington's favorite son. Reuben, say hello with a poem.
My mother in the afterlife. It is 1970 again. My mother is shaking her head at the sight of my clothing. She never abandoned her dream of a world without denim. Now there's no escaping her critique. You can't have coffee with God looking like this. She rolls her eyes at Abby Hoffman and at Bill, who owned the convenience store near our house. Death has restored her mind. Now she's talking curfew. My brother laughs behind a cloud.
Oh, this is the start of something big. I can tell. Reuben Jackson is the host of a Friday night special jazz program on Vermont Public Radio.
Right.
And he has long been a dignitary in Washington poetry world. He is the author of Fingering the Keys and hundreds of poems and articles and essays. He was the director of the Duke Ellington Collection at the Smithsonian. We'll find out about what that means later. But let's have another poem.
Okay.
We're just getting started.
It's another poem about my mother, who kind of, she had a prominent role in Fingering the Keys, but she was kind of the linchpin of our family, so that naturally worked its way into poetry. And this is for Sarah. It's called If You Met My Mother. She would be warm and a bit nervous, eyes darting between the crosstown stranger in love with her baby and some semi-distant space above us. She who worried about my love life in high school and beyond would find herself wrestling with race while seeking a smile sturdy enough to last through the pot roast she checks every other breath, until silently, stubbornly concluding that this just might be all right.
Reuben Jackson, what have you been doing? What have you been writing? What do you think you're doing?
You know, I think for many writers, it's a consciously or not, you have two or three themes that you work on, and maybe they expand in some ways. But I think basically what we do and what I've been doing specifically is, to quote the, it's an old spiritual, working on the building. And I would say it's like predominant themes for me are childhood, family, and, you know, you're honing and attempting to make sense of the path, I guess is the best way to put it. And I think as I get older, yeah, it comes out in the work, but just life in general, trying to make sense of things. And I think trying to give honor to the questions, the wonderful things, even the challenges, because it's, you know, all these cliches, I thought they were cliches I heard when I was young about life have turned out to be true. And in some ways, I think the more recent work is a way of giving thanks to people who told me things, who were encouraging, and to, you know, what I've seen and still don't understand what I've seen and things that have profoundly shaped me. So, that's it. It's a lot.
Well, you know, Reuben, acknowledgement is one of the highest spiritual principles in the universe. Mm-hmm. And you did it before you wrote it. You always acknowledged everybody. And so it isn't a surprise to me that your book is coming out of that DNA. And also, do you know any poet who is not always writing about their beginnings? Because it's
good
always
point.
With us.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you're coming at it from a different angle
right.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And some things that may have angered you before, you might even learn were good for you.
That's true.
I found.
Yeah.
But your mother has been a predominant person in your life.
Oh, sure.
And in your themes.
Mm-hmm.
And she will never die now that you're working on this. She never did anyway.
Right.
Let's have another poem.
Sure. This piece is for Trayvon Martin. And there's a certain irony in it for me because it's been anthologized like 10 times since I wrote it and had it initially published. It's coming out in some textbooks, like how to teach poetry to middle school kids and things like that. I'm grateful because, of course, writers want to be read and you know, that's kind of a given. But it's a poem I wish I had not written. I mean, I wish he could have just gotten home from the convenience store, and, you know, maybe I would have bumped into him on the street somewhere and said hello. But, you know, it's thinking about the process, not just the process of writing, but the fact that this is someone I never met, but whose last night on earth has profoundly shaped all of us. And so this is, it's for Trayvon Martin. Instead of sleeping, I walk with him from the store. No Skittles, thank you. We do not talk much, sneakers crossing the courtyard, humid southern night. We shake hands and hug, ancient stoic tenderness. I nod to the moon. I'm so old school, I hang until the latch clicks like an unloaded gun.
I can see why that's being used as an exemplar in a textbook. That last line, you bring it home with a bang, really.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about was, well, again, growing up and how my friends and I would say walk each other home from the store or from parties. And there's a kind of, there's a kind of stoic tenderness. It's taught and or learned. So it's like you have affection for your friend or friends, but you kind of wear that honor guard face. And when, you know, this tragedy occurred, I thought, I wish I could have just walked him home, because that's what we did. And to be, you know, a little colloquial, it's like you walk your boys home. And it's like a date almost, because you, like with a date back in the day, you'd wait until he or she or they got in the house. And it's the same thing. So for me, you know, a younger person, someone you know, or you know, metaphorically or not, and you want to get them home. But I think the key here is the ancient stoic, the stoic
that,
tenderness.
Those are the two words.
Right, yes.
Ancient stoic tenderness.
Yes.
That sets the whole scene
right.
Because it has a history to
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
And so give us another poem. Okay. Reuben Jackson is here from Vermont, but he's really ours in Washington.
This piece was in an anthology that came out some years ago that Rick Peabody put together. I know a lot of Poet and the Poem listeners know his work with Gargoyle and his many fine books of poetry, but the anthology is called Mondo James Dean. And when I wrote this, I was thinking about those photographs that Dennis Stock took of James Dean in his hometown of Fairmont, Indiana. And there was one taken after his death and burial where he shot the tombstone, and people had chiseled in, you know, I'll take the A, and they chiseled little pieces of the letters out to take home with them. So this is James Dean. Indiana is no place to be colored. Eyes on your every swagger. No homies to embrace like Sal Mineo upside Griffith Planetarium's darkness. James Dean's rose-red lips and jacket. Natalie Wood more distant than Mars and the anguished father Jim Backus played. Farther than the pockmarked tombstone where my camera and I cautiously gather around the abbreviated screenplay like smokers desperate for a light.
Nobody brings it home like you do. I thought James Dean was before your time.
Well, he died a year before I was born. So
yeah.
September 30th, 1955. Yeah. But you know how these, well, icons
well, he's
have
a
that,
legend, of
that
course.
Life, yeah, life beyond the physical life.
So that's, yeah, the image lasts. Mm-hmm. The image lasts.
And, yeah. And I think having seen Rebel Without a Cause, and these are references to Rebel Without a Cause, and that kind of, whatever they call it, CinemaScope, that kind of exaggerated color, which made, like, the lips redder and the jackets, everything was just that much more dramatic. So I was referring to that in the piece. And
I get that now. The rosy red.
Mm-hmm.
And Sal Mineo.
Right, who played a big role in Rebel Without a Cause, which is the...
Are you a film aficionado as well as a music scholar?
I love cinema. I'm more like a film soundtrack nerd, you know.
Yes, and you have done something with soundtracks on the
yes,
radio.
Yes, yes.
Tell us about it.
I do an annual pre-Oscar salute to Hollywood soundtracks on Vermont Public Radio, and it can be anything from, I guess, what people would call the golden age of Hollywood. So you have people like Dimitri Tiomkin and Max Steiner. But I've also included more recent, like, you know, Quincy Jones and Curtis Mayfield. But
that it's a big, no one is doing this.
A big hug to the tradition.
No one is doing this.
So,
So this is your life, Reuben Jackson. What were you like? I know you as a man. What were you like as a five-year-old?
I was extremely curious and self-conscious. I knew early on that I really loved language and music.
And how early on?
Two, maybe three. And there were things about music in particular I heard and wanted to know more about, like, kind of even technically. I always say music tapped me on the shoulder and said, let's go, let's go. And, you know, all my, you know, your peers like music, but I was the kid who would, you play records in my parents' basement, and I'd say, listen to what the cello's doing in the fifth bar, you know. And my friends would say, oh, Reuben, let's go play ball. But it was that level of
listening.
Love.
Listening. You
know? And I remember kind of going back to my mom. We were in the basement listening to a song by the group was really big in the 50s, The Platters, called Harbor Lights.
Do I not know?
And at the end of this piece, you hear, it's like, you know, those bells on buoys are chiming, and the strings are, well, I get a little nerdy, like these passing tones are playing. And I said to my mom, I asked Mr. Jacobs, the music teacher at school, what those were, and he said they were passing tones. And I said, they're kind of descending, like, you know, like the sun. And well, my mother, the key to this story is that my mother didn't laugh at me, because I knew this was something that touched me very deeply. And it meant a lot that she says, oh, yeah, let's play it again. So the curiosity, I think the passion, I struggle, I think, like a lot of young men, and then you become a not-so-young man with, it's like the tenderness in your heart, and how do you, what do you do with it? How do you convey it? I often quote the saxophonist Archie Shepp said, I pass through the insipid panorama of Americana with an enormous romanticism. It has never left me. And I knew that about myself early on. And you know, I had a neighbor named Jean who once said to me, I was five, she says, Reuben, I think you'll understand what I mean. It's like, she says, you hear the cellos. You have to be careful with yourself. And she was referring to this, you know, passion and romanticism. So curious, romantic, and self-conscious. That's a law firm for you, right? LLC.
Will you write a poem, My Mother Never Laughed at Me?
Oh, I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah, because this is the imprimatur in your life. Mm-hmm. She really early on was the one. Let's have another poem. Reuben Jackson's visiting us in Washington, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
I attended Goddard College in Vermont in the 70s, and as did our wonderful host, Grace, from 1975 to 1978. And this piece is called April 1975. And it has to do with, well, you'll hear what it has to do with, April 1975. Should my black Flatlander eyes lock on the other brother in the general store? The first I've seen since what seems like I can't count that high. Do I pretend I don't see other people pretending not to see us? Two brothers buying Triscuits and peanut butter, respectively, in northern New England is revolution on a Sunday afternoon.
Wow. Did you go back to Vermont and become a radio star because you liked Goddard so much?
Well, the radio was not planned. You know that old cliche about telling the universe you have plans, and then people say, oh, was that thunder? And they'll say, no, it's the universe laughing at you. I taught high school for 2 years in Burlington, and it was one of these.
What 2 years?
So I left in 2012. So 12 to 14.
Oh.
And it was good as far as teaching was concerned, and it was rough. With like the racial aspect was really bumpy with the community, because Burlington's a community struggling with acknowledging that racism could exist in Vermont, and black teachers are kind of like an anomaly, and I was naive and kind of smitten with the you know, you have these pastoral romantic images of how things are going to be. And it was very bumpy. It was, you know, I had really normal relationships with my students, which means they love you Monday. They don't like you Monday afternoon because you gave them a B+ and they wanted an A. Or you have like kind of the normal arc of the classroom. And then the community, I was like the latest attempt by many in the community to get and keep a good teacher of color. So it was kind of like Jackie Robinson sort of stuff. Not a lot of fun.
Have you written about that?
I think I have to leave to do it. Because when you're on the playground and your knees are kind of scarred up, I think you have to get off the playground to heal. And that's another reason I'm planning to... Well, I want to come back home anyway, but it's a process like everything.
I have to say... the reason I'm not asking you to read another poem every minute is because you are talking a poem every time you open your mouth.
No.
You are just a mad metaphor man. Let's have a...
Nice alliteration.
But let's have a poem anyway. Okay. Reuben Jackson at the Library of Congress.
Back to this notion of, masculinity and young men trying to become themselves and the way in which... My friends and I would, it's like the vulnerability would kind of poke itself, poke out like a blade on like a Swiss Army knife, and then you put it back. So that's kind of based upon this dynamic, and that's something I'm working on a lot now, is what it meant to, what was the price of this, to go back to the Trayvon Martin piece, this kind of stoic tenderness that we learned by way of kind of group acculturation and how we taught ourselves, So this piece is called "The Night Clifton Called Me Debonair." I know who yearns beneath the rail-thin facade you aren't so good at. There are sad waltzes in your laughter. If brothers like us could star in those foreign films no one has ever heard of, you would be the dude sipping arias in the nice apartment, your cologne the scent of wistful romance. So this is a case of, this character, well, Clifton is telling me, the irony with me was I learned how to try to keep like my heart at bay, but my face was, people say, don't play poker because they know what you're thinking. And we were walking home from a party and he had a couple of drinks and he said, basically he said, I know who you are. And he said, you remind me of those, I didn't know he knew anything about French cinema. He said, you remind me of those guys in those French films who, they go down to the little corner market and they're kind of staring off in the space and they've fallen over with all these beautiful women. And I thought, well, where is this coming from? And he said, if you tell anybody I said this, I'll say it never happened. So,
I'm glad
it's portraiture.
Yes, but I'm glad you're being so secretive now on 200,000.
Yeah, I know. There you go. Yeah, hiding
in
plain sight. Yes.
Okay, give us another poem because it's all coming out now.
Oh, dear. Okay, this is going back to when the World Series came on in the afternoon. And I would rush home from grade school because at that time, Washington, D.C. was was an American League town, which meant the Washington Senators were not going to be in the World Series. But I loved baseball and still do.
What year was that?
Oh, my gosh. We're talking... This piece is basically set like 1962, around that
time. Okay, we needed to know that.
Yeah, which is when, the American League expanded again, and because the first incarnation of the Senators had moved to Minnesota and become the Minnesota Twins. But it's called Early Autumn. That October, I took the express route to the back porch, where shadows long as Baptist sermons shrouded the aging black and white with rusting rabbit ears and the unheated room. My then-beloved Yankees were dying like the remaining vestiges of summer, humbled by the arm of Koufax, swinging without success, like apprentice jazz players. How could a wistful schoolboy see what even Roger Maris missed from the cheap seats on a set with failing eyesight 3,000 miles away?
That's a bit of history. Now, you were the director of the Duke Ellington Collection at the Smithsonian Institution.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, I was also a curator, archivist. The Smithsonian acquired Duke Ellington's papers in late 1988, and in the spring of 89, they hired myself and three other people to catalog the materials and disseminate information about Ellington, whether it was, attending conferences, symposia, and that kind of thing. So it was, maybe I was multitasking and didn't know it at the time, but I was one of the public faces of the collection, so radio, TV, interviews about the materials, along with curators like Dr. John Hassey, who's also retired. But we talk about the collection, Duke Ellington's influence, and of course you also make sure that the processing of the collection continues, because basically once the Smithsonian acquired the materials, people were knocking at the door wanting to get into the candy store.
But it's not a lending library.
No, it's
how do they get to see it?
You make an appointment
at the
Archive Center
collection.
At American History, right, like here, like with Dominguez papers and stuff at the library.
Would you be willing to say that you're the foremost scholar on Ellington?
No,
you know the most?
I think that I...
You know what's there.
I know what's there. I also think that the longer I was there and the more you try to learn about Duke Ellington beyond the facts, the more the fog would appear. And I think that was deliberate, because he was someone whose main thrust as far as the public was concerned was the music. And he's kind of he had an affable smokescreen. You know, he was very glib, brilliant, flirtatious guy. But beyond that, he only let you so far.
I see.
So as far as music and that kind of thing,
That's where his soul was.
Yeah, but getting to know him is fun to try to do, but it's like, eating soup with a fork.
Well said. That you could be a poet.
Reuben, it's not too late.
It isn't. And prove it to us with a poem.
Okay, this is more history. And my mom went to my father would work on weekends. Again, I'm a kid here in Washington, D.C., and I would go to the beauty parlor with my mother on Saturday morning, and it was just this great fount of, her beautician was a guy named Cordell, who had like 98 pictures of Sam Cooke in his station. He knew everything about Sam Cooke, and you'd hear all this gossip. Sometimes people would say things, and my mother would want to come from and cover my ears, but it was just like this smorgasbord of humanity. So this is based upon those experiences, which I just, all have in my heart always. Letitia's House of Beauty. Long before NASA thought Negroes worthy of exploring heavens, dark as we were once, Sarah Wilcox and countless other sisters, legs crossed like stars in a constellation, spent nearly every Saturday beneath moaning space helmet-sized dryers, trying to straighten and perfect that which was round and lovely as a planet, distant as the men upstate. Here you've got, I was thinking about people who were in the, women who were in the beauty parlor, same time as my mom. Some of their partners, boyfriends, spouses were imprisoned. And they would say, they'd either go to Lorton or they'd say, next weekend I'm going upstate to see whomever. And it was just so much to take in.
That's so powerful.
Yeah.
That is so powerful. Yeah. I got it, but I didn't get it. Mm-hmm. I thought the guys had just taken off. I thought the guys were gone.
And that could have been true,
and
too.
Upstate.
That could have been true,
It's just a generic term for having left.
Right, yes, yeah.
Having long gone.
But you've got a point. I mean, it could have been.
So it works. It becomes especially poignant.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that is, and there's more than ever, right?
More than ever upstate
these days.
Yes.
Wow, Reuben Jackson, we're at the Library of Congress, and we're rounding the bend.
I brought this poem because it's a little different for me, and I mean that maybe emotionally and technically to some degree, and I can, I'll talk a bit about the methodology, but it's The working title, I'm still, how that is, no poem is ever finished, it's only abandoned. But the working title is Love. After years and years of trying, like drivers all but pushing our idle cars back onto the road, the two of us, older survivors of illness, death, the superficiality of lattes, will bump into each other, shoppers on a quiet street spilling nothing more than canned goods, nothing less than a hello, reaching across the sidewalk like a hand which, without ceremony, would hold yours as it would that slightly dented can or the banister leading to your house.
The poem right. always starts with a feeling.
Yes.
And you have a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And so now let us have a closing poem.
Okay. Now, this piece is part of my work as a chronicler, as I'd like to say. I've for this gentleman, Amir Yassin, who's a 79-year-old barber in Detroit, and he's a friend of my late brother's. Anyway, he writes poems between, you know, clients at the barbershop, and he'll like text me and say, "Ruben, write this poem down." Well, he fell in love with a woman named Khadijah Rollins, who's a CEO in Detroit. And they kind of tease him at the barbershop because he's a sweetheart, but he'll give you that look if people ask too many questions. And one thing he's fond of doing, I'll say quickly, is someone says, "Boy, you've really changed since you met Khadijah." He'll take his straight razor and go to the little strap he used, and he'll just go like that. Now, he wouldn't cut anybody, but it was his way of saying, don't talk about this because it matters. But Khadijah was at a, he told me she was at a conference, and he was thinking of her, so he wrote this. And it, all his pieces to her began, of course, "Dearest Khadijah," because, you know, he says, well, I'm from that age. I roll this way. "Dearest Khadijah, the other night as I was driving home, I reached my free hand across the passenger seat. I imagined you holding it before the light changed, and I returned both hands to the wheel. I found a parking space two blocks from my apartment beneath a huge maple. Oh, Lord, I love this crazy city, and turned to kiss you anyway."
Thank you. This is Reuben Jackson, the voice of Reuben Jackson, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is brought to you by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Also, Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue and Candace Katz. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.